Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm not a perfect person.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Friday, May 22nd, 2020. The headlines all talking about the political standoff in the state of Illinois. This is a headline in my beloved Bright One. Skeptical downstate judge may still get crack at governor's stay-at-home order. Man, this the Hang'em High judge, Judge Michael Mahaney. One more time. I will never get caught doing anything remotely wrong in Clay County. I got to go before that guy, Hang'em High Judge Michael Mahaney. We'll take a deep dive in Mahaney and Darren Bailey and all the interesting characters who are leading the MAGA hat resistance in the state of Illinois against J.B. Pritzker. We'll do that with our distinguished guest. And as I ask all distinguished guests on Bonus Time on the Ben Jarofsky Show, I ask them, please introduce yourself. So, guest, introduce yourself.
I'm Eric Zorn. I'm a veteran columnist from the Chicago Tribune, and I steal my ringtone from the Ben Jarofsky Show.
That's correct.
Yes, this would be the same Eric Zorn that I really unfairly accused of stealing my ideas in a show I did last week. We each wrote the same column on the same week. And then Eric, classic Eric Zorn style, you rebutted me point by point in an email showing me the timeline. When my story came out, your story came out. So you vindicated yourself, Eric. You have been acquitted of all charges. You feel good about that?
I feel good, yes. I'm free, free as a bird. No, it was interesting. The thing is, I thought it was a really interesting topic. I mean, just to refresh the listeners' memories,
go ahead.
Don't memorize our columns. I wrote about the accusations that Tara Reid was launching against Joe Biden. And I said, okay, fine. But let's talk about the very credible rape allegation against, I mean, there are a bunch of allegations against Donald Trump, but there's a very credible rape allegation against him. And let's not lose sight of that. If we're going to have to pick somebody who's more rapey than another, let's look at Donald Trump. And then you did the same column, and I think we posted on the same day. And your column went into a lot more detail than mine did. And you really laid out the case of why that rape was plausible allegation, and of course I imagine you got the same kind of hate mail that I got on it, which was, you know, people saying that you try to make an excuse for Biden and that Democrats are hypocrites and they don't believe women and the whole nonsense that you hear about that. But, it was an interesting time.
Yeah, it was. E. Jean Carroll is the woman's name. She's actually a fairly significant journalist from back in the day. She, if you take a look at her bibliography, the articles she's written, books, she wrote a biography of Hunter Thompson, Things I Know, Eric. So I would say it's a little difficult to just dismiss her allegations. And she wrote I don't know, did you read her article or full article that was in New York? It was an excerpt from a book she wrote, which I've not read the book. I plan to get it out of the library when libraries open. But I read the excerpt that was in New York Magazine. Did you by any chance read that excerpt?
I read the excerpt. And I did not read the book also. I read the excerpt that was in New York Magazine where I took my information and quotes from too.
Yeah. Well,
we're bad people not buying the book right now.
Well, I will. I will. You know what? I think I will buy the book. I want to support her fellow journalist under siege here. But it's interesting. I wasn't actually planning to talk to you about this, but this is what popped into my mind. The difference between a journalist confronting a subject, trying to be sort of funny about it, and a plaintiff in court. So sort of the tone that she takes in the book almost dismisses the attack to a certain degree. And she attempts to leaven it with humor. And it was obviously a very, it had a profound impact on her life. And she's followed up with a lawsuit, trying a defamation lawsuit against Donald Trump, who said it was all lies. So right now they're in court. As I point out in my story, the judge has to rule on a request by E. Jean Carroll to force Donald Trump to turn over his DNA so they can compare it to a sample of something that's on her dress with overtures to Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton. So this is a very important case, but I don't know if you noticed that, like, the tone was a little different in the article than her tone has been in the lawsuit. Did you notice that, Eric?
I haven't read the lawsuit, so I don't know. But yeah, I mean, the tone is, it's chattier, right? I mean, that's, and it befits her whole reputation and her career as an advice columnist and someone who's very comfortable communicating with people in that way. So yeah, I find that whole story very believable. I don't think the DNA that's on her, is it a coat or a dress that she has? I don't think it's unwholesome DNA. I think she just thinks that it's somehow like he touched her dress or something like that. So that I'm not sure what that would establish, other than that they had physical contact of some sort, which doesn't mean that it was a rape. But yeah. You know, it's like one argument that people make is like, hey, you know, this was baked into the price of Donald Trump. Everybody knew that he was this kind of guy. And so we shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be offended. We should just say, well, this is what he did. This is who he is. And people voted for him anyway. Everybody knew that the Access Hollywood tape is no surprise. This is not, people know Joe Biden is sort of handsy and overly friendly, but nobody thought he was predatory. There was no allegation he was predatory until Tara Reid. So that changes that narrative, whereas this just reinforces a known narrative about Trump.
Well, the portion of the story that both of us hammered on and is what I feel is the double standard on the whole issue of discussing the behavior of politicians toward women, male politicians toward women. It's an issue that the Democrats must confront. It's not an issue that the Republicans confront. Just to follow up what you just said, it's just sort of baked into who Republicans are. Well, that's just how Republicans behave. Our voters don't care about this issue. Republicans have shown this time and time again down in Alabama in the special election. Roy Moore, who they nominated to be their candidate for Senate. This is not an issue that motivates Republican voters. Even now, There's not even the slightest inkling of a debate on the Republican side as to whether it's appropriate to have the president, the leader of the Republican Party, have an accusation of rape. And that's just one accusation. Whereas on the Democratic side, there's debate, there's discussion, there's analysis. So that's why, you know, Eric, I always feel compelled whenever I write about these things to point out, well, this is just a debate that exists on basically one side. Do you agree with me on that?
Well, yeah, it's the Democrats all fighting with one another. A lot of the mail that I got on this came from the far left, the people who were, I think, still hoping that if somehow Biden could be shamed into resigning, that this would elevate Bernie Sanders to the nomination. And that's just not going to happen. Bernie Sanders is not the number two pick of the Democratic Party. The way the party's organized. This is not like, you know, if you're the first runner-up and the winner can't fulfill his obligations, you get to take away the crown. This is a situation where the Democratic Party says, look, we wanted a moderate, and we nominated a moderate, and if he doesn't work out, then we'll just pick another moderate. We'll stick another moderate in that way. Amy Klobuchar or something like that. that it's not going to be Bernie Sanders. So, but there's a lot of agita on the far left about this. And one of the things that, that they point out, which I think is plausible, which is that if we had known about this back in December or January before the Iowa caucuses, before Super Tuesday, anyway, that the party voted, that all the party forces that aligned behind Biden at that time would have thought, well, this is going to be just too much of a problem. Let's find somebody else. And I got to say, I'm in that mindset. I was in that mindset, too. I still sort of am. I think it would be nice if the party could find somebody else, because I don't, I have some questions about Biden's ability to manage things and run a campaign. I was disappointed. Today is Friday, and he goes on his talk show and he says something like, if you don't vote for me, you're not really black. And it's like, well, that's just a dumb thing to say. I was like, isn't he know better? He's been in politics all his life. He doesn't know any better than to say that. And I just wonder what kind of gaffes are going to come out of him in this campaign, and whether the Republicans are going to successfully portray him as someone who just is unfit for the presidency. I worry about that.
Yeah. I think his exact quote was, "You ain't black." I think that's what he said.
even better.
Yeah. I'll respond to this. And I've come to this conclusion. And by the way, just to finish up where you were saying, my lefty friends, my far lefty friends who come at me go, Ben, we get rid of Biden, we're going to be Bernie. I voted for Bernie. I'm a big Bernie supporter. Everybody knows that. It's not going to happen. Bernie Sanders was, as painful as this is for me to confess, Eric, and confront, he was rejected by roughly two-thirds of the Democratic electorate. And he did it even worse this time than he did against Hillary Clinton. I voted for him each time. To me, he's one of the most courageous politicians of my generation, and I really look up to him and admire him. But the reality is the rest of the Democratic Party didn't see it the way I saw it. So they're not going to replace Joe Biden with Bernie Sanders. So using Tara Reid's accusation as a leverage in your mind to get Bernie put in the ticket as opposed to Joe Biden is delusional. It's just not going to happen. I'm with you on that. And I'll go one step further. I've now come to the conclusion that no matter what Joe Biden does, no matter what Joe Biden says, no matter what comes out of the closet about his past, it won't matter, Eric. I do not believe Democratic voters are swaying in any way. They are determined to oust Donald Trump. They're determined to undo the damage of 2016. And they just see Joe Biden as the perfect kind of candidate for that task. And you watch, I'll bet you, as in the days that unfold, with the response to Democrats by Democrats to his latest gaffe, that the one he did today, "You ain't black" gaffe, will be very similar to what you hear from Republicans regarding to Trump. Oh, that's just Joe Biden. That's just Uncle Joe. That's just how he goes. And they'll roll with it. That's my guess of how things will go down.
Well, I guess I got to say, I hope you're right about that. And it's only fair, I guess, that the parties are playing this way, that if the Republicans are going to go, "Oh, that's just Trump," then the Democrats are going to have to, are not going to have to make the perfect the enemy of the good. And I do think that I mean, I don't even know how good Biden is. You know, I've certainly, I think I said this to you in emails or conversations, Biden wasn't my first choice. He wasn't my second choice. He wasn't my third choice. But, you know, I think I ended up voting for him because it was at that point, it just looked like, what's the problem? Well, I mean, there's no race anymore. By the time I got to Illinois, it didn't even matter anymore. Right? So I just wanted to have a little bit of show of strength for him, because it was important for me that the party gets behind him. Because I do feel that way. I have another thought for you here, that maybe the news today about Biden was good news for Kamala Harris.
Something that you caught me off guard with that one. Why do you say that?
As a vice presidential nominee.
So now he's going to have to take Kamala Harris?
Well, I don't think he's going to go with Stacey Abrams. I think that her lack of experience in government is probably going to be too much of a mark against her. Mm-hmm. And I think that I do think that when you make a racial gaffe like today, it makes it a little bit more important that you make it up to black voters. And so I just, if today's remark has any impact at all, it might be to push him more toward Kamala Harris. I don't know.
Well, I'll put this out there. And Joe Biden's a regular listener to my podcast, so I know he's listening. He will, and listen to this, Joe. I don't know how you cannot nominate a black woman. I've said this all along, Eric. Joe Biden's part of Joe Biden's electability, part of the reason why he was able to defeat Bernie Sanders, he had widespread black support and was particularly helpful on Super Tuesday. And he has that widespread black support in because he was sort of the Robert Culp character in the updated version of I Spy. I'm really showing my age there. I think Eric may be the only person listening who knows what I'm saying.
I know the reference.
Okay. Everybody else is like, huh? What the hell? I Spy. Yeah. And so I just think it just makes sense. Keep it going. You had a black man at the top of the ticket, and Joe Biden was the dutiful wingman. And now Joe Biden's at the top of the ticket. You have to have a black. This is how I see it. I felt this all along. And my personal favorite is Stacey Abrams. I never thought he was going to take her. I've always thought that he was going to choose Kamala Harris. But this notion that he's like flirting with Amy Klobuchar as a nominee just really scares me, Eric, because I just see it as Tim Kaine part two. I know my lefty friends, there's no way they're going to get fired up. They're going to get anti-fired up over Amy Klobuchar, and I just believe that it just would be a dud in among black voters too. Do you have a favorite, your personal favorite that hope he chooses?
My personal favorite would be Elizabeth Warren. I think she'd be great. I don't think the politics work out for her. I wonder about whether Harris is going to. I mean, Harris is. Got some problems, you know. Her record as a prosecutor is gonna haunt her a little bit. But the fact she's an African American woman, I think will play well. And there's a great segment of African American voters that are not far left at all. I mean, they in many ways are a moderate voting bloc politically, their position. So she might work. I'm very impressed with her in terms of like her ability when she was doing some questioning of. Kavanaugh and things like that. I thought she was very sharp. I can imagine her in debate just ripping Pence to shreds. So I guess if I had to advise Biden right now, I'd probably tell him to take Harris.
What's that?
You still would advise him to go with Abrams, you think?
I would advise him to go with Stacey Abrams, and he would tell me to, you know, go F myself. I don't think in a million years he's going to take Stacey Abrams. And all along I've been predicting he would select Kamala Harris. And your point about his latest gaffe sort of underscores that. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, I think he's going to take Kamala Harris. I'll be very disappointed if he doesn't take a black woman. He's already said he's going to take a woman. And I just feel as like I just feel the Democratic Party, in a sense, owes it to black women. And I say this as a, you know, we'll have this discussion about journalists admitting their who they vote for and their worldview. Look, I'm a host of a podcast. I write a column. Everybody knows where I'm coming from. So I'm a lifelong Democratic voter, and I've seen the Democratic Party's, next to me, the most loyal voters the Democratic Party has, black women. And I just don't understand how the Democrats can continue to overlook the support they've received from black women. It was so obvious in Alabama. I don't know if you remember that election from 2018 when Doug Jones was defeated Roy Moore. And so I just feel as though this is a moment where Joe Biden, you know, could sort of make, you don't really make good on how he handled Anita Hill, but it's just like a sign of appreciation. So that's generally how I view it. Do you share some of those same feelings?
I do share some of those feelings. And I think that's why I think Harris is probably a smarter pick than Abrams, because Harris does have her her electoral bona fides and, people know her, I think, a lot better than they know Abrams. And, you know, Abrams, I find her an impressive person. I see her interviewed and so on. But I think Kamala Harris is really ready to go. So I would guess that's where the pick's going to go. And I wanted to, you know, you brought up this idea of you know, you're identified politically in a certain way. I certainly am also, the columns that I write. It brings up this point. I don't know if you've been following this, all this fighting about Amy Jacobson. They've been following up.
Oh my God. Love to talk with you about it. I talked about it for quite a while with Ramana Hussein on the earlier show, which hasn't dropped yet.
Oh, okay.
So, but yeah, get your thought. Amy, why don't you explain to people what the background is, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, just real quickly, the background is that you know, Amy Jacobson was a longtime TV reporter for Channel 5, and then she had an ethical problem and she moved over to WIND, the conservative talk radio station. I think for the last 10 years or so, she's been a sidekick to Dan Proft, who is a conservative activist who has a morning talk show on that station. And she had been appearing at, or virtually, she'd been appearing at the news conferences with Pritzker and submitting questions. And the questions were kind of aggressive and self-centered and kind of strange. Then she spoke at a rally last Saturday, but she spoke at a rally where she was leading these Open Up Illinois protesters and calling for, you know. And so then after that, the the governor's spokesman said, you know, no, we're not going to take your questions anymore. Mm-hmm. You're not a member of the media. This is a news conference. It's not a media. It's not an activist conference. And I thought that, and there's a lot of bellyaching on the right about this, saying that, you know, this is your First Amendment rights, and this is the governor being heavy-handed. And there were some people on the left who were agreeing too that this is, the governor should not be deciding who gets to ask any questions. But my view on that is that there's a difference between an activist and a journalist. And I can, you know, in my case, and probably your case as well, I can write columns all day long about how I think Rauner's a bomb. J.B. Pritzker was the guy to vote for. I can't put a bumper sticker on my car. I certainly can't go introduce Pritzker at a rally. I can't put a sign in my yard. It's just that's where the line gets drawn. And she should have understood that. She didn't. I guess she didn't understand it. I guess a lot of people on her side don't understand it. But that's the, we don't have. It's not a news conference open to everybody. It's not a news conference that's open to activists. It's a news conference is open to people who are acting as journalists, and even opinion journalists are welcome there. John Cass gets his questions from time to time. I have no problem with John Cass getting his questions. I think he should be able to. He's a working member of the media. And I have no problem with you or me getting our questions in there. But that really I thought crossed the line, and that's where I came down on it. Where did you guys come down?
Well, I am all over the map with this one. The part, typical me, the part that really irritated me the most, I didn't know about this story. I'm late to learn this story, Eric. So, you know, when Ramon and I were talking about what issues we were going to review, she mentioned that. So I had to look it up because I was a little behind at times, I must confess. So the part that really irritated me, and I don't know Amy Jacobson. I've never met Amy Jacobson. I got to preface by that. I've never heard her show. I'm definitely no fan of Dan Proft. Who is her sidekick, apparently. But the part that irritated me is that she would show up at a rally where people are flapping signs with swastikas on it. See, that's the part of the Republican Party I don't get. So if Amy Jacobson or Danny Proft want to be Republican, that's their, you know, they identify with the MAGA hat. Donald Trump's their guy. They revere him. Okay, I get that. You have to take a stand, in my humble opinion. And you can't... You should take a stand and denounce the people who are waving swastikas at your rallies and confront the fact that the Republican Party has allowed itself to merge with far right lunatics, Nazis, swastika wavers.
Yeah.
And
no, I give Jim Durkin credit, the Illinois House Republican leader. He confronted one of those sign wavers in Springfield this week. I mean, he's like, he said, like, this is not acceptable. This does not represent me or my party. I thought that was really an important thing.
Me of all people, been ripping Jim Durkin for all these years because he was Bruce Rauner's legislative leader when they were assailing unions. And everybody knows I love unions. But I'm with you, Eric. I applauded Jim Durkin, and I will always give him a little break now. Even when he was assailing the yesterday with the vote on by mail balloting, and he was, you know, leading the charge against it as a Republican. I guess that's the talking point they have to follow these days. But I have to give him credit. And so that's the part about Amy Jacobson I don't get. You know, you want to go ask questions of J.B. Pritzker, but and you want to talk at rallies where they got the swastika? Don't you know that J.B. Pritzker's Jewish? Don't you know that he has family members who were killed in the Holocaust? Don't you realize how offensive that is? And how disgusting that is? And you're worried, you're sobbing over the fact that he wouldn't let you ask a question? That's what's on your mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally agree. On the other hand, I mean, I think even if there weren't those signs there, even if there weren't all that Nazi imagery and symbolism going on, it's not appropriate to lead a rally. That's not what we do. I mean, as much as you go on your podcast and write your column, I do the same thing to advance points of view, we're not activists. And once we cross line into that, then our whole definition changes of who we are and what our role is.
Well, I don't know how absolute this, because I will now give an example, alluding to one of the giants of our industry, a man that I revered when I was growing up. My probably number one favorite journalist of all time, Mike Royko. And I believe it was in 1981 or 1980, around there. And I can't remember when it was exactly. So forgive me if I have the wrong year. Mike Royko led an anti-gun rally, an anti-handgun rally in Daley Plaza. I believe he was still working for the Sun-Times, Eric. It was not the Tribune.
If it was 81, it was the Sun-Times.
It was the Sun-Times. I remember Cloris Leachman spoke. I went to the rally. I remember Bill Veeck. God bless Bill Veeck was at that rally. He used to own, for our younger listeners, he owned the White Sox. And he was quite a maverick. And there were protesters, to the point I was making about Amy Jacobson, there were protesters in Nazi uniforms across the street. Like, they were counter protesters, and Veeck ripped down their banner. I love Bill Veeck. And he fought in World War II, and I guess they have a First Amendment right, but he didn't see it that way, Eric. He ripped down the. So I don't know if it's as absolute as she does not have the right to speak at a rally and then pretend she's a journalist. I don't know why she would. She's just doing that to embarrass Pritzker. So we all know what that's all about. You know what I'm saying? But I don't know how. So what's your thoughts about Mike Royko leading an anti-handgun rally?
I was in town in 81, but I don't remember that. And I don't think it was the right thing to do. I don't think that you do that as a journalist. I think that you cover a rally. You write columns that they may read at the rally. But I don't think you lead a rally. Still say that you're a journalist. Now, obviously, you're right. Mike Royko is in the pantheon of great American journalists, and so you've argued me right into a corner. But he could not have gotten away with that working at the Tribune today or any time. And one of our foreign correspondents got in a ton of trouble for speaking at a rally in Canada. He's our Canadian correspondent, back when we had foreign correspondents. And he was not even speaking. It was a rally. It was like, some sort of, maybe it's anti-immigration or something like that. But he just gave a speech, and they said, can you come and just explain to everybody what's going on in Parliament, or whatever they have in Canada. So he just got up and he gave a speech about what was going on. He didn't advocate for any position, but this was covered in the Canadian press. It got back to our editors, and they were just furious. Mm-hmm. I think they may have suspended him. It was certainly a huge issue. And so I don't think that was right what Royko did. May he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. He's the greatest. By one more example to talk you in a corner, this is could be like a civics lesson. Another legendary Chicago journalist that I revered when I was growing up, I don't know if you shared my reverence for him, would be Irv Kupcinet, who was known as Cup, who's a gossip column for the Sun-Times for many, many years. He was the master of ceremonies at a Soldier Field rally in the 60s that was organized by Martin Luther King, calling for civil rights and open housing in the Chicago. Cup was the master of ceremonies. And I think about this a lot, Eric. This is the 60s. I kind of like really respect Cup immensely, because he did that, but by today's rules, that too would be off.
Yeah, Cup is an interesting case, though, because Cup was almost more of a celebrity with a column in a way. I mean, he wasn't, I don't know where Cup fits into journalism. He did break stories. There's no question about that. And of course, it's like you've made it really hard because civil rights is such a, people still argue about guns. I don't think serious people argue anymore about civil rights, at least they shouldn't be. So you put me in another trick bag, of course. But standards were, I think, somewhat different back in the 60s, which is how we looked at those things. So I don't know. Okay, so you've got 2 points in your favor.
I struggle with these things, Eric.
I'm glad I was going to write about this for Sunday, and I didn't have room for it and wasn't clear that I had anything new to say about that. And I'm glad I didn't, because then people would have been throwing Cup and Royko in there.
There's only one person in the city of Chicago who would have thrown it at you, and you're talking to him right now. I can guarantee you I'm Rain Man when it comes to things like this. Nobody else remembers that handgun rally. I was there because, I idolized Mike Royko. And then just seeing Bill Veeck there, just who I also idolized. And Cloris Leachman gave a very kind of, I don't know if anybody knows Cloris. She's an actress, a very good actress, by the way. I think she was in town. She was doing some play in Chicago. So she spoke out and she started talking about sugar. She kind of went off on a tangent about diet and how too much sugar causes an imbalance and that leads to aggression. It was like, okay, you know, that's not the kind of speech you're going to get at normal gun rallies or anti-gun rallies. So anyway, it's on my mind. All right, let's move on to a column that you wrote last week, or maybe the week before, I can't remember which. I've been talking a lot about this, and get your thoughts on this. Darren Bailey, the downstate Republican, who's decided to become the public face of the resistance to J.B. Pritzker's stay-at-home order. He's gone to court to challenge it, to have it ruled unconstitutional for a while. He said he would not wear a mask, even though Michael Madigan insisted that all state reps had to wear masks when they convened for their first meeting since the pandemic. And you wrote a column that I was cheering, that you said he should be barred. What's your thoughts now in the aftermath of all that, of Darren Bailey and his great revolt against Pritzker?
Well, as you know, he did go in on Wednesday to the opening day of the session, and he wasn't wearing a mask. And then one of the first things that they did from the chair was they made a motion to adopt these new rules, these new special pandemic rules for the session that's in this convention arena. I guess it's in the Bank of Springfield arena or something like that down there. And so they can all keep their distance. They made the rule that you got to wear a mask, and then someone made a motion that Bailey be ousted, and they basically, I think they voted pretty much along party lines to oust him. And of course, Democrats have 30 vote majority I forget what it is. It's a huge majority in the House. And they just voted him out. And he didn't make a scene. I mean, I was expecting he might go limp and they can drag him out or something like that. But he walked out waving and smiling. And then he came back on Thursday wearing a mask. And, you know, my point about masks is that. If these guys, and I sympathize a lot with people who are very frustrated about the economic dislocation of this of lockdown rules and the problems that people are having with it. It's not. People say, oh, they just want to get a haircut or they want to be able to go to Applebee's. But I think there are a lot of people who feel like this is really impacting their work, their ability to make a living, and it's bothering them in a lot of different ways. If we want to end this lockdown, the sooner we all wear masks, the sooner we all adhere to some of these common sense guidelines they have that don't infringe on any sacred freedoms, then the sooner we can get back to normal life. And the more we have people like Darren Bailey not wearing masks, insisting on their rights to go and gather in great groups of people who gathered in the taverns up in Wisconsin immediately after the Supreme Court ruling up there, that's just going to prolong this problem. I mean, you're going to be podcasting from your attic for many months more, and I'm going to be writing columns from my attic for many months more. And it's like, you know, that's what's just infuriating about it. It's that these guys are actually hurting their own cause by not doing this. And if Donald Trump would wear a mask and tell people to wear masks, then they would wear masks because they do what he tells them.
Yeah.
They don't wear masks because, you know, a lot of people think this is a sign. If you wear a mask, you're a sign that you don't like Trump or you don't believe in Trump. And if you go barefaced, you're a Trump supporter. And that's, you know, the way that this issue, this pandemic has been polarized is making it worse. It's making it the recovery slower. And that's what I just want to get through the thick heads of some of these people who are fighting on every little point. And I don't know. I was really glad to see that the Democrats handled it the way they did, and glad to see that he came back with the mask the next day. And I also was glad to see that somehow they got a photo of Trump wearing a mask Thursday when he was touring the factory in Michigan.
Yeah.
Progress on that.
Very bizarre. Republican revulsion to wearing the mask. Now, you raised a good point I hadn't thought about. It begins with Trump. So if Trump put on the mask, D.B. Dara Bailey would probably put on the mask as well, because you're absolutely correct. They just follow the leader with Donald Trump. That's where their party is going. If Trump openly denounced Nazis and people who have swastikas on their signs, then the Republican, maybe Amy Jacobson, would suddenly realize that being a Nazi is not a nice thing, and she would denounce that. So you're right. Maybe that's what it takes, Donald Trump, to tell them, because he's their ruler. What's your sense of, well, first of all, what was the reaction that you got from Republicans, Republican readers, when you ran that piece?
Well, as you know, there are always going to be these studies that you can find where someone will say wearing masks doesn't do any good or doesn't do much good. And I realize that the science, if you wear a mask, you're not fully protected. And I never said that. And I don't think any serious person that says that you wear a mask in public is going to keep you safe for sure. It cuts down on the transmission. It means that the virality of COVID-19 becomes lower. It doesn't spread as easily when people are wearing masks. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the pretty broad consensus in science, but you can always find some study where somebody says it doesn't do any good at all. And so people were sending me those studies. And then there's the usual hate mail, you know, like you're a coward, you're a meaning liberal, and, you know, this kind of thing. So,
you're a coward.
The usual. A coward.
Yeah. We've had one of our guests, Candace Castillo, opine that the revolt against Democratic governors and their stay-at-home orders really kicked into gear after the first articles came out noting that the black mortality rate is higher than the white one when it came to COVID. And anything is possible, Eric. It could be in some people's mind that they've jumped to a conclusion that only black people have to worry about this. The absolute opposite was opined for a while before the pandemic hit home. I don't know if you were following this. There were like these little messages on Facebook going around that this is a disease that won't hit black people. I mean, utter insanity in America right now. Do you follow what I'm saying? Where like these racial distinctions about COVID. Do you buy anything into that theory about people, Trump supporters, somehow or other don't think this disease will affect them?
I don't think that they think it won't affect them as such. I think there's a perception that it does not hit people who live in rural areas and it doesn't hit young people. I mean, you can't deny that we've had close to 100,000 deaths in this country, and we're getting up on 5,000 deaths in Illinois. I don't think you can deny that, but it is heavily concentrated among older people, and it's heavily concentrated among people in the more densely populated urban areas, and also it's concentrated among African Americans. And so I do think that consciously or subconsciously, you have people who think to themselves, well, you know, this is a disease that's hitting old black people in Chicago. It's not hitting middle-aged white people in, you know, Vermilion County or whatever. So, and I don't know if they're actively thinking that or if it's just a sense that they have. So that changes the way engage with the whole issue.
And finally, we'll close with this column you wrote about the newly elected president of the Fraternal Order Police, John Catanzara. Give you a lot of credit for this one, Eric. Take some guts to write the kind of column you wrote in this particular case. You very strongly denounced him. He is a Trump supporter, among other things. You did not denounce him on that front, but on his record against him. I know that if a reporter in this town takes a strong stand against the leader of the Fraternal Order of Police, you're going to get backlash. You're going to get emails, and they can be kind of intimidating. Let's be honest. It's one thing to make fun of Darren Bailey, which I do all the time, but it's another thing to criticize a police officer or the head of the Fraternal Order of Police. You know, people have guns. People have the power to arrest you. Let's talk a little bit about your concerns about Catanzara as the head of the Fraternal Order of Police. And before we do that, have you gotten any kind of like hostile response or threatening responses in the aftermath of that column?
Hostile, yes. Threatening, no. I've heard something that I heard that surprised me after that was that I did hear from people who were from police officers who told me that they shared my feeling that he wasn't the right guy, that he was sending the wrong message. I'm not sure that they have the same visceral reaction I do to him. And just to refresh memory, he's been in the force since the 90s, and he's got 50 misconduct complaints against him. 10 of them have been sustained. And he's right now, he's been relieved of his police powers because he filed some nonsense report against Eddie Johnson for when Eddie Johnson was overseeing the protests where Father Flagrant's people blocked the Kennedy Expressway for a short time. Mm-hmm. And so he's got this long and sort of unpleasant record, and he's a blowhard. He shows up in city council meetings. He's wearing, the cops like to call a Mayor Lightfoot Groot. You know that? You seen that? Mm-hmm. I guess I think she resembles this character in the Marvel comic world. I'm not sure where it's from. But they a lot of name calling. He's part of this whole really, really angry faction of police officers who hate the media and feel like every time we write about cops, it's always to criticize them for doing something wrong. And my point is, we don't write that often or often enough maybe about cops who do great things. But part of our job is to monitor them and make sure that when they do step out of line, we write about it. I don't apologize for that. So my bottom line with Catanzara was, you have a guy with this kind of bad record. He sort of represents kind of the worst of what police officers are. I mean, he's like almost a caricature of a blowhard bad cop, kind of a clownishly bad cop. And they elected him to run their union, and I think it's bad for the image of police officers, and it's not going to help them in their contract negotiations. And they've been, close to 3 years now without a contract. And to negotiate a contract, you've got to have some level of respect and trust across the table. And when you've got a guy who's wearing insulting shirts to city council meetings and has a disciplinary record like this guy has, you're not helping your cause. And it's just, some police officer wrote to me and said, this is just an expression of our anger at not having a contract and how we feel we've been disrespected by the city for all this time. So this is a sort of them giving the finger to the city and giving the finger to the media at the same time. And anybody else is going to tell them who's going to represent them and who isn't. So, that was their Donald Trump in a way. It was them. I mean, you think about it, Donald Trump was a completely inappropriate person to elect president. I mean, and I say this in almost a nonpartisan way. I mean, he had none of the experience or the policy chops or anything that you would want in the president, but he expressed anger that people felt, and that propelled him to victory. And I think that happened with Catanzara as well.
Wow.
He was a vehicle for their anger. So.
I have to say this. I absolutely, with the cops, they should have a contract, and it's ridiculous, the politics that the police contracts and fire contracts in the city of Chicago, and how this is not just something that emerged right now in the era of Lori Lightfoot and Donald Trump. this is something that's gone on for years. I can just remember so many times contracts expiring and then cops getting the retro pay. I remember back in 2009, here, more Rain Man memories for you, Eric. The police, no, 2007, the police officer, I was cheering him on, the Fraternal Order of Police, when they rallied at City Hall against Mayor Daley's Olympics because they didn't have a contract. And it was quite a turnout at City Hall, and I was with them because I was against the Olympics. So this goes back in time, the way mayors dawdle on these things. You know, they're playing games with their budgets. So I don't know. I think it's a little. I'm just going to disagree whoever wrote that with you. I think it goes beyond a response to contract, the politics of way mayors deal with contracts. When you elect as the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, a man who's openly in supporting Donald Trump in a city that voted 80% against Donald Trump, at least, I'm just doing off the top of my head, Eric, 80 to 85, whatever it was, if they voted for Hillary Clinton, it'll probably be higher in this election. Then you're kind of setting yourself up for, I don't know, bad optics, rough PR.
I think, as you know, and as most unions know, when you're in, especially public unions, when you're involved in negotiations with teachers down south too, there is obviously there's the dollars and cents, the nitty gritty of the contract negotiations, but there's also the public relations angle too. And it's like you want the public on your side, and so that's a lot of the maneuvering that you saw during the teacher strike was, whose side are you on? You saw polls being taken. You saw a lot of conversation. I side with the teachers. I side with the city, or I side with the CPS. That's important because if the negotiators on the school side, in that case, feel like the pressure's on them from the public, open schools, give the teachers what they want, these demands are reasonable, this is a reasonable group of people, we respect them, we admire them, we like them, that pressure is going to change the negotiation. Versus if you've got a guy who is an open Trump supporter, who is a loudmouth, insulting guy with a bad disciplinary record, he's not going to represent your interests very well. And that's why I thought it was not a smart move for the cops to elect him. That was my take on it. So I guess we'll see. Maybe he'll have the force of personality to enact a great contract.
Yeah.
I doubt it.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe he'll be like Nixon going to China. All of a sudden he'll have a rapprochement with the left in the Chicago. We'll close with this. Any updates about the Tribune? I know the Tribune, the Reader, the Sun-Times, we're all hanging in there in these dire times. All union. I think we're all member of the same union. How are things going at the Tribune?
They're not going very well. This week, the dreaded hedge fund took over control of our board. And they will then, I guess they are sort of locked into place until the end of June, at which point they can begin swinging their side. Our union just negotiated with management for every union member is going to have to take 3 unpaid furlough weeks this summer, one a month in May, June, and July. And that was, we talked them down from a permanent pay cut, so that's where we are right now. And I think that things, as I've told people, I said, if this is as bad as things get, I'll be surprised, and that'll be good because it's doable. Missing three weeks of pay is doable, at least for me, and I think for most of the people on staff, if that's all it is. But I think it's just the beginning. You see these media cuts everywhere, and I feel like we're all in this together. We're all facing the same sort of problems with advertising drying up, and we have a lot of readers still, but we don't have the advertisers. And I think the problems that management is facing are real, but at the same time, you don't want to take these publications that are so important to the city, and all, the Reader and Sun-Times and Tribune all together are a very important part of the city and the coverage that they provided. If you start just taking those and selling them off the parts or destroying them, you've got a lot of issues that aren't going to get covered. A lot of politicians, and the politicians will love it because they can get away with much more stuff with it if the eyes aren't on. So it's a tough time, and I know it feels a little bit self-involved to talk about it. But I think as institutions, these are really important institutions to save, and I hope that somehow we can all struggle through this.
No,
that's where we are.
Yeah, you sounds like you're in the same position. I may ask Charlie Johnson and Mary Wisniewski to come back and show and talk about it a little at greater length. I love having them on anyway. But I used to laugh, joke about the people at BEZ, they would have to make those appeals. And now I realize I'm doing it all the time myself because that's how we survive, particularly at the Reader right now. So I'm with you, and I understand what the people at the Tribune are going through. So let's hope we can all get out of this with our jobs and with the people doing their jobs. Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah.
Keep up the good work, all right?
Great talking to you. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's great, Eric Zorn. Seems like we're thinking alike a lot these days. Take care, everybody.